If you'd like to take up your Bibles then, we're going to be looking into the Old Testament again this week, to Numbers chapter 13, and it can be found on page 149 of your pew Bible. And we're going to read a sort of mixture of verses so that we get an idea of the story without having to read a lot of names and so on. So we're going to start at verses 1 to 2, then 17 to 20, then 25 to 28, and verses 30 to 32. So starting at verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders." Verse 17. When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, "Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they walled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land." It was the season for the first ripe grapes. Verse 25. At the end of 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community of Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. "We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there." Verse 30. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Jane. So, if you are on the Bible journey with us, well done for surviving Leviticus. And we're now in the book of Numbers. And so it's Numbers that we are looking at today. I want to give us a brief overview of the fourth book of the Torah and a few pointers to help us on our way through it. Unlike Leviticus, which has got this beautiful V-shaped sandwich structure that really helps you understand what the book is all about, Numbers doesn't have anything like that. It's a much more meandering structure, which in a way kind of fits the subject of wandering in the wilderness, which is what the Israelites spent the whole of that book doing. It's a book that shows the Israelites finally on the move after spending a year camped out at Sinai, the mountain of God. A year in which they've learned to live on manna. They've built the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. They've found out how to get into it when God is there. And they've begun to get themselves organized and ready to move on. It's also a book that catalogues no less than seven rebellions. Their onward journey is anything but plain sailing, and the people find it hard to accept God's direction They find it hard to accept Moses' leadership. They find it hard to accept the rules and regulations that have been put upon them. All sorts of things cause them difficulty and pain. And that's before they have to deal with enemy tribes or confront the reality of moving into a promised land where there are people already living there who don't want to move over and make room for them. So it's a book of struggles. But it is also, indeed, a book of numbers. It begins with a census, and there's another one towards the end. So why don't we begin with this idea of numbers and see what it's got to show us. Taking a census is, if you think about it, a sign of being organized. If you're part of an aimless rabble, you don't find yourself sitting down and counting each other, do you? You just mill about in a state of chaos, arguing about what to do next. So we should think of the counting as a sign of progress, actually. When the Israelites left Egypt, they were runaway slaves. Nothing more than that. They had never had to make decisions for themselves before. All they had to do was whatever their slave masters told them to do. They didn't have to worry about where their food was coming from. Their slave masters gave them food. They didn't have to organize themselves. The Egyptians did that. So all those things had to be slowly and painfully learned. All the laws and commands, the daily provision of manna, the leadership of Moses and Aaron, all this was part of teaching the people how to be a nation, not a mob. And so we find lengthy descriptions as we read into Numbers, not just how many people there are by tribe and clan, although there's plenty of that, but even the order of the camp, the marching order for when they set out, who gets to carry which bit of equipment, where exactly each tribe will be in relation to the others, and in relation to the tabernacle at the center. It might be mind-numbingly boring to read. Yeah, it is, actually, let's be honest. But here they all are, laid out to the north and the south and the east and the west, with God at the center of an orderly, structured community. So this is progress. This is not how they were back in Exodus, when they were panicking, getting their toes wet on the edge of the Red Sea, and the Egyptian army was coming up behind them. They've come a long way in 12 months. They're disciplined. They're structured. They're ready to march. Another prominent theme that I've already mentioned is that of rebellion. In Numbers 11, people complain about their hardships. God gave them a treat, a flock of quail, which made a welcome change from nothing but manna every day. But that didn't stop them complaining. A little bit later, Miriam and Aaron, Moses' own brother and sister, challenged his authority. Later, a group of people challenged Aaron's right to be the priest, which led to their destruction. Later still, facing a shortage of water, Moses' own patience finally snaps, and he earns a rebuke from God. And later still, near the end of the book, God sends a plague of serpents to punish the people for their impatience. And only when Moses demonstrates his authority over the symbol of evil by holding up a statue of a bronze snake does this scourge relent. Now, I want to home in on one story, which was the one that Jane read to us. It's the fourth of the seven rebellions. So it's the middle one, and you know how I like the middle of things. It sums up all sorts of things for us. And it does it in ways that should be familiar to us. And if you're tracking and if you're bang on track with the Bible journey, you have read it yesterday and today. or that's what's in store for you. We haven't had time yet to do today's reading. And there's one very well-known story that is echoed through this story of the spies going into Canaan. And I wonder if you can guess what it is. Just look at the instructions that Moses gave when he sent the people out. Page 149, beginning at verse 17. When Moses sent them out to explore Canaan, he said, "Go and see what the land is like. Is it good or is it bad? Oh, and do your best to bring back some of the fruit." So Moses talks about seeing, whether it's good or bad, and he talks about fruit. Does that remind you of any stories in the Bible that we might have read before? I wonder. Do you remember a story that also involved a snake, about seeing some fruit and deciding for yourself whether it was good or bad? Yeah, we're back in Genesis, in the garden, when the snake deceived Adam and Eve and they ate the fruit. And the snake promised that they would know what was good and bad for themselves. Didn't end well then, did it? When somebody was asked to see whether something was good or bad. I wonder how it's going to end this time, when someone's been sent out to see whether the land is good or bad. Well, if you know your Bible as well as an ancient Jewish reader would, those bells will be dinging away in your head as you read this story, thinking, oh no, here we go. This isn't going to end well, is it? So what happens? Spies go out, they look at the land. Oh, it is certainly a rich and fertile land. Even today, this is the logo of the Israeli tourist board. It's a stylized picture of carrying a bunch of grapes that's so big and heavy that two people have to carry it on a pole. And that's the idea of the promised land. So rich, so fertile, flowing with milk. Milk comes from domesticated animals, goats probably in those days, and honey. Honey comes from bees, which are wild. So both domestic and wild yields their abundance. This is a good land indeed. But unfortunately, the spies are rather intimidated by what they see. They said, "Yeah, we went into the land that you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large." And of the 12 spies that went up, only two of them speak up and say, "Don't worry." Verse 30 in chapter 13 says, "And Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, 'We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it.' But the others spread a bad report. They said, 'We can't attack these people. They're stronger than we are.'" Now, Jane ended her reading at the end of chapter 13. We didn't get to hear the reaction of the people at large. Who do you think they believed? Did they believe the 10 spies who were scared? Or did they believe Caleb and Joshua, who thought, "No, God will give us the land"? Well, if you were to flip the page to chapter 14, this is what you would read. "That night, all the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, 'Oh, if only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness? Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to each other, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. There they are, on the point of rebellion. Getting rid of Moses and choosing someone else is going to take them back home, back to the safety of slavery. It's the old story, isn't it? All over again. When they have the chance to see if they will have faith in God's promise or trust to the way things look in their own eyes, people make the age-old mistake. Only Caleb and Joshua stand firm, and the outcome is that only Caleb and Joshua, out of the whole mighty crowd of people, will live to get into the promised land. But it's not all bad, this book of Numbers. There is the strange and wonderful story of Balaam coming up. There's a little highlight for you to look forward to in the days to come. After they've been spending some time in the wilderness of Paran, they begin to edge a little bit closer to the promised land and enter the territory of Moab. And the king of Moab is disturbed by this huge group of people traveling through his land, so he hires a sorcerer called Balaam to curse Israel. But Balaam finds that he can't. Try as he might, every time he opens his mouth to utter curses against Israel, out come blessings instead. Three times he tries, and he finds he can only say good things about Israel. And not only that, but God then gives him a vision of a future Israelite king who will one day bring God's justice to the nations, which sounds very much like the promise that was given to Judah back in Genesis chapter 49 as Jacob lay on his deathbed, giving blessings to his 12 sons and saying, from you, Judah, will come one who will be a ruler of my people. Now, it's worth stopping to reflect on the flow of this book so far. The stories of rebellion in the wilderness have been heaping up and getting worse and worse. And while God does bring partial and momentary acts of judgment against Israel, he's also shown mercy by providing food and water along the way. And the Balaam story shows God's grace in vivid colors, while the people down in the plain are arguing and grumbling and rebelling up on the hills. God is protecting and even blessing them. And it's this contrast between Israel's rebellion and God's faithfulness in the wilderness that makes these stories so important for later generations of Israel. The wilderness stories were retold over and over again by the prophets, by the poets who wrote the Psalms, and by the apostles who wrote the New Testament. You can find loads of examples when they look back to the wilderness years and say, learn a lesson from this. When you had no faith and turned away, God was faithful to you. They saw these stories as a warning. God will forever remain faithful to his covenant promises, but he will allow his people to walk away in rebellion and face the consequences of their actions. The rest of the book of Numbers focuses on the children of the wilderness generation who are growing up now as their parents die off, getting ready to inherit the promised land. After the second census is taken of this new generation, they win a number of battles with the people groups on the edge of the promised land, which enable a few tribes to settle on the far side of the Jordan before the main invasion which will come. And the book of Numbers concludes with a new generation of Israel, ready to enter the land. There's a pause, a moment of rest, which allows Moses to deliver his final words of wisdom and warning. And that's what we're going to find in the next book of the Torah, Deuteronomy. So it's also worth just pausing for a moment to think about the whole of these five books together. Because although Numbers doesn't have a particular structure, the Torah as a whole does. The books at either end match each other. Genesis matches Deuteronomy. At the end of Genesis, we have Jacob on his deathbed, pronouncing blessings and curses on his descendants. In Deuteronomy, we have Moses, just before he dies, pronouncing blessings and curses as the people of Israel face a choice. You're going to go God's way or the highway as you get ready to enter the promised land. In between that, we have Exodus and Numbers. Exodus is going from Egypt to Mount Sinai and beginning to become God's people. Numbers is going from Mount Sinai towards the promised land. And then in the middle, Leviticus, the book that explains how it's possible for an unholy people to meet a holy God, centered on the Day of Atonement that takes away the people's sins and makes it possible for the tent of meeting to work, for God and the people to have a relationship so that they are able not just to be any old tribe or nation like all the rest, but to be God's chosen people, the ones who have a true relationship with him. So we can read the whole of these five books as a lovely V-shape that take us all the way from the very beginning of things through to the entry of the promised land. But let me finish by asking, what does Numbers have for us? Is it a book of warnings? Is it basically saying to us, whatever you do, don't do it like this? Is it a book of promises? No matter how far you stray, God is still faithful. And you can always come back to him and follow his ways. Is it a book about preparation? God in his mercy didn't let the Israelites take the direct route from Egypt to the promised land. If they got there in a month, which they could have done, they would never have been ready to fight for the land. They would have given up. They would have been destroyed. It took a generation to get them ready. Do you feel sometimes at St. Cuthbert's that we're just marking time? Why aren't we out there contending for the faith? Why aren't people flocking to join us? Maybe we're in a wandering period, a time of preparation, a time for us to be organized with God at the center until we're ready for what he's preparing for us to do. Maybe Numbers fits us better than we think. Amen.